Welcome to the Data Life podcast. In this podcast, we talk about real life experiences with data, personalities, tools, and more. Today, we are talking with Patrick McClory, who is the founder and CEO of Introspect Data. He has lots of experience working in statistics, math, and data science fields, as well as consulting with clients. Today, we'll be talking about what makes someone a good data scientist, the different roles in the industry, and we'll also cover data ownership and ethics around data collection. Without further ado, let's welcome Patrick to the episode.
Hi, Patrick. Hey, really appreciate it. Happy to be here.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah. So how about you introduce yourself? And I also had a question on how, like you have a psychology major. So I wanted to see how that played a role in your transition into the field of data science and computer science.
Yeah. So again, my name is Patrick McClory. I'm CEO of Introspect Data. I have built a couple of firms and worked in the consulting field around everything from cloud and DevOps from its inception, now in the AI and ML space. I've done a lot of work with helping organizations kind of get over that sort of technological hurdle or those hurdles that are holding them back, and everything from software architecture to being that, sort of executive's strategic sort of assistant or coach to help organizations really make the most of technology in their world. And what's kind of funny is, like you said, I've got this degree in psychology. I kind of joke with people that it was kind of 4 years of self-medication in college. But as I look at it, it really helped me in two huge ways. The first, kind of early in my career, as I was building sort of the consulting sort of acumen and skill set, was really, having the ability to kind of see people and understand sort of the industrial organizational psychology side of it, how people in groups work and how they make decisions and that kind of thing to help them kind of make better decisions. But as we get further into this data science world, I spent a lot of time studying, neuropsychology, which is more the biology of kind of what's going on inside of people's heads. And a lot of the testing that's done around that is, very finely tuned, statistically, sort of an analyzed to the nth degree, sort of long form questionnaires. And, if you've ever sort of been in that world, it's not always, somewhere everyone wants to be. But if you've ever had to like take one of those or had a friend or a kid who needed to go through that process, like they're lengthy and long, and they don't seem to make a lot of sense. They ask you the same question over and over again, but they're really finely tuned. And the skill I learned in that is not just the how to ask good questions and correct and build a statistically valid test, but also the analysis of it. So that mm-hmm. data analysis side was really something that continues to kind of come back for me. As someone who has done a lot of software engineering, I've always tried to bring that together. And, I find that I'm having a lot of conversations with my clients, even in our own products around how do we best use data. And I find that I've got all these, fun little statistical tricks up my sleeve to, mm-hmm. ask, is that, you may feel like that's a cool idea, but is it significant? How do we know? Do we understand what's significant in this conversation at a statistical level? And, we may make decisions because of gut feel, but we still ask the question, is this actually, statistically or some mathematically significant? And, even some of those simple questions have paid off in dividends in my business and consulting conversations in my clients' businesses. And, as we move into ML and AI, it's that on steroids, right? It's the continual evolution of that sort of core practice in the real world.
Yeah, that makes quite a lot of sense. And you said statistical significance. I think that's something not many people are very comfortable with. And I feel that's like something, it's one thing to say that there is an 83% accuracy, but like, what's the kind of margin? I mean, I don't see machine learning community talk a lot about kind of like the range of confidence or error interval or confidence intervals.
I think that's what's really powerful about this kind of new wave of analysis techniques. And it's not so much that we can, sort of speculatively pick something out of the blue and forecast things and sort of do so in a, like, I always hate these hand wavy sort of solutions. And that goes for everything from data analysis to DevOps and software architecture. Like I'm a very sort of, you know, lead intentionally sort of, you know, kind of both engineer and executive. I like to know why I'm doing what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. And even if I'm telling myself I'm doing this because it feels like the right, you know, like experience tells me this is the right thing, I can't really quite, you know, articulate it. I still want to be honest about that. Right. And a lot of times I'll come back to like test my own assumptions and I'll go straight back to like basic linear regressions. Right. I'll go, yep. You know, try to find some sort of algorithmic pattern or, you know, get into sort of multivariate statistics, you know, and see if I can, you know, backtrack into something that gives me some confidence. Cause I look at, you know, R values in those situations and, you know, the sort of the confidence ratings of these algorithms as really the key linchpin to the entire thing. It's, you know, it's cool that I can do something, but how much can I quantify the confidence that, yeah, you know, you used to really only qualitatively be able to talk about?
Yeah, I think that makes sense. But like, what's your kind of like the step-by-step procedure you take around these confidence intervals? Like, say you run a model on a training data, like, I'm just curious. I mean, it's kind of like, yeah, something that I would love to learn as well.
So I think that a lot of it has to do with the, you know, the way that you build and sort of metric these models. And I think Keras does a great job of allowing at an epic by epic level or kind of a stage by stage level, you the ability to sort of, you know, take a peek in there, grab some statistics and start to graph that. And if you're familiar with, if listeners are familiar with kind of basic, you know, sort of text classifiers and categorizing algorithms, you know, they'll come out with like loss functions and, you know, all of these, frankly, you know, sort of complicated, what I see as sort of secondary and tertiary level sort of moving metrics that identify, yeah, sort of a class of error, like mean standard error, mean squared error, you know, sort of the you're seeing the effects of the confidence rating change, but you're not actually talking about the confidence rating. You're talking about, you know, an amalgamation of several sort of views of it. And don't get me wrong, there's super, you know, sort of valuable information there, but, you know, when it gets down to it, whether or not the mean error is high or low, there are a couple of different variables that go into that. You know, what I really care about, if I've got a high, you know, mean squared error, I've got a high, you know, my loss ratio, my loss function doesn't, you know, sort of continue to drop, I really want to know, you know, based on a known data set, what's the percent likelihood that I'm going to be accurate? What is, you know, how much better am I than, you know, pick a metric? And one of the things that I find is helpful, not just for myself, but for clients who are trying to understand, you know, what this whole brave new world does, is like, let's pick a metric and compare it. Let's have a bake off. Let's compare it to human error. Let's just try it. Like, we'll build a data set. You find a human, I'll train a machine. Let's come back tomorrow and let's just play with it. And like, let's make it tangible and, you know, talk about it with your hands on it instead of it being this sort of distant concept. Because, you know, I think a lot of people get into that fear mindset around the machines are going to come and, you know, they're not going to come kill us, but they're going to take our jobs. And I think, you know, that's, you know, it's a tough conversation because sure, there are a lot of menial tasks that we can take in and sort of model, you know, all those rules of thumb that we have, those heuristics, you know, we can model that into something to make it so that what you spend your time on is valuable. Like, I don't need my team to do the same thing over and over and over again. Like, if they've got a pattern that they follow and they're just following it, like, could we train a model? Could we look at something like robotic process automation in combination with some ML to, you know, make sure that people are doing the work that they're truly good at, the things that require creativity and, you know, sort of that big wide context and communication and collaboration. I think that in this wave of AI, because there's bound to be many of them, that where I really see the easy and strongest value is in augmented process and augmented, you know, sort of context for decision makers. And that's that's really kind of, you know, where I take it, and we take it to heart that, you know, as we build our own product set, like we're really focused on, you know, not how do we go build the singularity, because I don't think anyone's ready for that. But it's about building tools that take, you know, sort of big nebulous contexts, you know, that take sort of these questions that are gut feels today and, you know, to the point of confidence. How can I qualify or how can I quantify your qualitative context around that? How can I give you a number that admittedly isn't going to be the only input you use, but how do I, you know, how do I help you be dispassionate about data? And I think that's the hardest part, is that we like to find patterns we're familiar with, and we're not, we as people aren't really good at looking at data and telling it, or kind of like, you know, calling it as we see it. It's like, oh, I see in that pattern. I see this. And what you really see is, you know, what we would call confirmation bias. We see what we want to see.
Yeah, I think that's a really good way to explain the concepts of like quantify the qualitative things. I think that is really kind of important. That makes sense. Which actually brings me nicely to the next question, which is that you have worked with so many kind of like clients and data science projects and also data scientists. According to you, what makes someone a good data scientist? What are the kind of skills you look for to evaluate them?
Yeah, so this is a really tough problem because I think it's changing. And, you know, I always like to look at other patterns, you know, not because I'm looking for my own confirmation bias, because, you know, but I am. But I'm looking for heuristics to kind of judge where this might go and where things might be going. And, you know, I was lucky enough to be in the right place at the right time around the kind of first wave of DevOps, and was, you know, was able to kind of not just ride that wave, so to speak, but to watch what happened in that process, where kind of developers and ops and admins kind of came together and worked more closely together, even in some cases were in fact the same person. And one of the rules of thumb that I sort of came together with from that is, or kind of came out of that process with, is that, you know, developers who have more context make better decisions. And that's business context, that's technical context, that's all of it.
Yep.
You know, it's not about horizontally sort of, you know, siloed, discipline focused teams. It's about how do I drive to completion with, you know, the right context and the right people. And we've seen that with dev and ops. You've now got this whole dev sec ops thing with security sort of trying to come into that world. And I see this data science role and data in general as sort of ripe for renaissance, that there is this, there's, you know, I remember the, you know, the days of the database council, and, you know, we would all joke about, you know, the guys would go get their robes on and walk into the conference room and talk for 3 hours about things that no one else would know about. They'd come out, they'd make decisions, and thus saith the database council. And, you know, humorous as it wasn't that far off, frankly. But it moved really slowly. And, you know, for a long time, that was okay. But as DevOps has accelerated, as security is sort of starting to accelerate, like data has to accelerate. I think that data science role is interesting because it's really kind of three roles that we talk about. You know, we if we're talking at a business level, the data science role is really, you know, three sort of engineering hats that have to be worn. It's a, you know, sort of first and foremost, a person who understands the data as it applies to the business. Second, a person who knows, you know, how to manipulate that data to find value in it. And third, someone who has the capability to actually go do that work and figure it out, how to like operationalize that. And you often see sort of a data scientist role that's more businessy and more sort of, you know, I would say hands-off, and a data engineering role that, you know, kind of comes out of that big data world, you know, more often than not. And I tell you that my frustration, and I don't know if you've seen this, but is that you've kind of got these two separate points of view, and they're really kind of off in their own camps. And getting those two roles in any sort of, you know, sort of large corporate environment to come together and like work on the same problem toward the same outcome. It doesn't at all look like it does when you do that with DevOps people or DevOps and security people. It is still very much the, this is my world, this is your world, and that space in between never really connects. And I think, you know, that is where I see the sort of, you know, the best people in this space, the best, you know, whatever title they have, right? The best data scientists, the best data engineers, the best data people are really the ones who can bridge that gap, who know how the data applies, who know the tricks. And some of them aren't even terribly good engineers, frankly, but they know what's possible and they know how to lead a team to go figure that out. And I think that sort of bit of knowledge at what's possible, the sort of view of the world from the forward side on the business end is important. And then it's all about being curious. It's being able to like we said, be dispassionate about the data, to look at it and say, well, okay, this is what it means. Not just here's a pretty picture, but you know, we are this percent confident that this trend is, you know, meaningfully accurate. And if you have people in the sales side of the world listening, I'm going to apologize profusely now. But like I always use this example of sales teams where I've worked with some great sales professionals. A lot of them always come back to me and say, hey, you know, I've just got this gut feel that we're doing great this quarter, or I've got this, I feel like the team's really doing well. And, you know, I've had a couple of opportunities to find people who are willing to let their guard down, which is always a tough thing when confidence is important on the sales side, right? So, you know, we've been able to kind of go dig into that and ask, well, what does it really mean? What does it mean to have a good gut feel? And can I quantify that any for you? Can I help give you a better measure that's outside of your own gut feel that can help you lead better? And invariably, we find some really interesting stuff that challenges the assumptions of the team. This always works better when the sales team is doing well, because you're not telling them the things are going bad and challenging their assumptions about everything at the same time. But that idea of can we step back and put our assumptions aside for a minute and see what we see, and that discipline is something that is it's not natural for most people.
Yep.
And like finding people who are not only good at doing that themselves, but leading other people through that exercise. Like if there's one thing that I would interview for, that I look for, that makes the best data scientists, is it's that ability to both be dispassionate about the data and to lead people through the process of being dispassionate about their data.
Yeah. That's a really good point about also being a leader and driving and kind of leading people to do the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I've built several companies. I was SVP of platform engineering at Datapipe prior to it being acquired to Rackspace. Like, if we're going to talk title, I have these. I've had some great opportunities. Mm-hmm. I still write code. I still look at data, and I'm convinced that sort of today's world of technical leadership requires, you know, having at least a meaningful level of background, you know, on the technologies. Like I'm the one who brought up Keras already. Like I was playing with that earlier today. It doesn't mean that I am by any means the deepest expert on, you know, sort of any one given technology, but I would tell you that I know enough to both be dangerous and to go build a proof of concept. So, you know, and that makes me a little unique. I think that to be able to lead technical teams, you have to be able to build confidence and kind of win some trust there. But you also have to know what's possible and what's not. And, you know, sometimes there are, you know, these great ideas that start as, well, you know, we can connect these two dots, it'll be great. But then you look at, you know, at a technical level with just a little bit of background, you go, those two dots are never going to connect. Like they're going to connect, but it will cost us so much to do that. At a business level, it makes little sense for us to try to make, you know, this talk to that, or for us to, you know, build a a hardware deployed, you know, sort of GPU cluster that is, you know, holding its data in the cloud. Like, why would I want to do that? Why don't I, like, yes, it's more expensive per hour for me to use GPU on Google, Amazon, or Microsoft's Azure platform. But the cost of data traversal, the cost of, you know, how much slower that would be if I have to backhaul all that traffic against, you know, even a dedicated network connection, even if I put it at like InterNAP or Switch that's sort of centrally located, even if I did everything I could to make it as fast as possible, I'm never going to get past that performance hurdle, and it's going to hurt us all day. So is it a better financial decision today? Mm. Yeah. Could we engineer the heck out of it and make it maybe okay enough? Sure, but we'll spend way more money doing that than we would, you know, just kind of going with the general pattern. And there's like, that's, you know, a recent example of a great, you know, sort of really deep financial conversation that comes out of these, is it technically possible? Uh-huh, kind of answers. But it becomes a, do you really want to do that? Do you want to live with what that looks like? Yeah. And the answer is usually no.
That kind of makes sense, actually. Yeah, sure. So let me just summarize the last few minutes of our conversation. You talked about how a good data scientist is someone who can do like the statistics, like the confidence intervals, someone who can get dirty with the data, but also know what data to use, someone who is good at like kind of the business and the sales side as well, where, you know, he knows, or he or she knows, like kind of like the big picture view of what this data is going to be used at. So yeah, that's a quite a bunch of skills. So, I mean, that's something that is really helpful to know. My kind of follow-up question on that is this advice works well when you work for someone else, but you have experience starting companies in data science. I want to know like kind of like how to take that to like the next level in entrepreneurship.
Yeah. It's a tough thing to take your own medicine sometimes. And I would tell you that, so this is, I think this is my, like officially the third company I've started from day one. I've worked with a number of startups kind of, I worked for a number of startups early on. And I had a chance to work with a kind of a startup foundry, kind of a group that built startups, back when I was in college. So I've seen a lot of the early stage process here. And what I'd tell you is that the hardest part of all of this is actually not a technical one. It's not even really a data problem. It's understanding that it's totally a personal issue. Like it's understanding that like the company is a company, that I'm a person, and that me as a person, my value isn't the company. They're two different things. And that, you know, as a data nerd, like it really plays out as, you know, I have to be ruthlessly dispassionate and ruthlessly honest about the data. Like, what is the data showing me? What is the marketing data showing me? Like, if I go and make a bet and I spend some money on advertising, or, you know, we go and build a tool and it, you know, sort of works, but it doesn't. And our customer, you know, first of all, what are the numbers look like? What is the revenue of the company look like, and how are we growing? But, you know, what are the customers saying? And not just what are they saying, but how are they saying it? You know, there are a lot of people out there, and you know, it's a little easier in the tech world because you can usually get a little bit more objective answer out of people in that, you know, who come from that background. But there's a lot of bias for being polite as well in a lot of that feedback. And I think that it's important to, you know, read into all of the feedback that you get, but not take it personally. And that's a really difficult thing to kind of do, because you've spent all this time working on something. You've built this thing. It's your baby. It's not your baby. Mm-hmm. It's a company. You got to remember that. And then, you know, once you get there, you're like, well, what works and what doesn't? And, you know, what do we want to bet on? What do we want to, like, we're trying out a new, I think we're going to launch it in the next week or two, a new sort of contact form for new clients, where instead of just saying, hey, who are you? Give us your name and write a little note. We're expanding it so that we're going to actually use some basic machine learning kind of on a natural language processing level to not just sort of make sure that you give us real detail, but to actually start the process of building your project plan while you're like after you submit it while you're waiting, we'll build you half a project plan and show you, hey, this is what it would look like to kind of start going down that route. Or, hey, it sounds like what you're trying to do is X, but what you say you want to do is Y. All right, well, how do you, like, instead of us just getting on a phone and showing you a PowerPoint, let's actually just talk about what you're trying to do and kind of start to use these tools to accelerate, you know, to the point earlier, how can I use these tools to accelerate the point where I'm actually adding value instead of just wasting your time telling you about the dog and pony show? I'm not a good salesperson. I'll be really honest. I'd rather talk about your problems all day and help you take a step forward than try to promise you something that then will deliver. I'd rather just start, you know, demonstrating it early and that, not just in our conversations, but all the way on the website.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Like, start delivering value right when the customer is signing up. I mean, that's a really great lesson. Then the third pillar is, so we have covered like being a kind of employed data scientist, and then you have covered a little bit about the starting the company bit. The third one is a little bit like being a freelancer or a consultant. And it's becoming very hot now in data science to kind of call yourself a data scientist consultant, right? So
yeah,
I wanted to hear your thoughts on that and like how to...
I have a lot of customers who've been burned by that. And, you know, whether it's on like one of those third-party platforms like Upwork or it's, you know, sort of just on their own, like I think that there's a tendency for people to like the title and take it and figure out that they can use that to pick up a gig here and there, to then find that they're in too deep. And a lot of those contracts don't run very long. So you're in too deep. You kind of get in there and mess around with things, but you don't actually, you know, finish anything. And you end up leaving customers with this sort of, and this isn't everyone, I know that, but you know, I've seen a lot of people leave customers with like that bad taste in their mouth of, oh, this is data science. Well, that isn't really what, that's not really useful. That wasn't helpful. And it comes from kind of two things. One, you know, people just trying to jump in without sort of some foundations, which I think is both totally impressive that people are willing to do that if they're truly curious and want to learn. If it's an opportunistic thing, maybe I'm a little more critical. But I also think it's a really huge expectations problem with customers. So no matter if it's freelancers or, you know, in my customer base, I find that customers have these really wild at times, or, you know, extremely inaccurate opinions as to what data science can do for them. And can I tell you like a 3-minute history lesson that gets me there? So
yeah, go for it.
So like the way I see it, if we look at the 80s to today, like storage has just become so cheap. Backblaze did a great blog article a number of months ago, could even be a year or two ago. They kind of cataloged how it went from thousands of dollars to pennies per gigabyte to store data. So it was ludicrous for a CTO to even sit there and make decisions about what data to keep and what not to. It was so cheap just to buy more storage and hold it that you end up with this sort of goldmine mentality of like, well, we've saved all this data. Now big data comes along and that was going to solve the problem, but it really didn't. Yeah.
Yep.
And now you've got these sort of these marketing messages around what data science is capable of. And they're not wholly inaccurate, but they miss the fine print around, well, you got to worry about preparing the data and getting it ready and making sense of what you actually have versus what you think you have. You have to, you know, the middle piece of it's actually really well done. There's a lot of great algorithms in the open source and, you know, the cloud world where, you know, you prepare your data, you shove the data in, it gives you some really interesting insights. But then the question is, well, what does it mean at the end of the day? And without some of that sort of statistical background, without a little bit of, you know, decent math and, you know, or at least a curious, you know, mindset around researching what those sort of stats really mean, you know, interpreting that becomes a real big problem. And I see the entire ML sort of market right now as a first mile and last mile problem. That chunk in the middle is, you know, for now, it's got some good solutions and there's a lot of cool stuff in there. But getting started and finishing are the huge problems. And I find that freelancers who maybe don't have the, and it isn't necessarily like a business intelligence background. It's really kind of like just core statistical and data background. And I'm not talking about like SQL Server. It's like literally the math. If you don't have some of that info or at least some of that background, even if it was a decade ago, and go refresh yourself, go reread the book, go look at, you know, some of the sort of lesson plans on Lynda, or is that even a thing anymore? Maybe not. You know, whatever the, you know, whatever kind of is in that sort of continuing education world, just refresh it just a little bit, get yourself kind of back up to speed on how to look at that data. And if you aren't familiar with it, shoot, there's so many good resources out there to learn this. I find that freelance, close it with this, with all of that, I find that those, you know, some of those freelancers who are, you know, sort of jumping in with both feet without that background, they're really eager to please. They're trying to help, and their heart's in the right place, but in being eager to please, they tend to set bad expectations and they tend to kind of jump to conclusions. And I think that that's really dangerous for clients.
We'll be back right after this break to talk about the different roles in the industry. Welcome back. Then the kind of the next question is like, how do you see these different roles in the industry, like data engineer, data scientist, machine learning engineer, data analyst, business analyst? Like, I mean, there are a bunch of roles and anyone could call themselves data scientist now. Like, I'm just trying to, what do you think? Like, do you have any science around this?
Yeah, I mean, I tell you this, that I've never been one for titles, personally. Like, I know that titles are important for people at an HR and a career progression level. I'm always more concerned with what people are actually doing. So I like to talk about roles and kind of what hats we wear. And you know, how we shape that into like a title is another thing. And I think that, you know, you've got, you know, I try to keep it simple. You've got the role of, you know, sort of getting data that you have or taking data that exists and making it useful for, you know, some sort of analysis. That you've got the role of figuring out what types of analysis you need to do. And then you've got the role of making that analysis happen. And from there, you've got a fourth role, which is, what does it mean? Like, how do I interpret it? Whether that's visualization, whether that's presentation, whether that's just looking at it, saying, "Oh, that's what this means." Like, you've got these sort of four roles that, you know, get different titles, and frankly, I think, you know, play best when you have people who fulfill one or more of them at any given point in time. But you know, I think that, you know, that role of like, how are we going to analyze this stuff, and what does it really mean? Like those two hats, the sort of the decisioning and the interpretation, you know, generally are very separate in the, you know, corporate world from the doing, the how are we going to accomplish this? And again, I think that, you know, the best people I've worked with in this world, come, you know, oddly enough, not from a formal data science background. One of them was a physicist. She was freaking phenomenal. PhD in physics, worked for the White House Office of Policy, like had done this wide variety of things. And she was insightful to the point of asking good questions, even when she was asking questions out of her own sort of naive perspective. You know, that asking good questions, interpreting results that, you know, to the need of the person who's listening. I don't even want to say business here. I want to say you want to interpret the results, you know, from the perspective of you know, the person who's listening to what you're saying. The receiver of that information, you know, you're giving them a lot of really complex, you know, sort of output. How do you make it so that it's tangible to them? And come on, I'm not going to sit there and explain mean squared error to everyone. Like, I'm not but how do you explain how a forecast model actually works, and that yes, it does cover periodicity and seasonality, and you know the further out we go, the less confident we are, but you know, in this range we feel it's good, and that's because not just of my experience, which is helpful, but because of these numbers, and this tells me that this range is what we care about. That isn't something that, and it's a really stereotypical problem from, you know, the days of old. Engineers tend to struggle in those conversations. And people who are more businessy and data sort of who are the BI analysts or the graph drawers who talk to the business, generally, either don't go far enough, they don't dream big enough, so they end up kind of not doing anything interesting, or they dream too big and their projects all fail because what they wanted to do wasn't possible or wasn't time for it yet. And that's not a problem that's new to this world, to technology, to engineering. And again, I think that there's this this need, and I see it starting for organizations to start to look at data not just as strategic and interesting and look at it because we need to do machine learning, but look at it from that interdisciplinary perspective of, when I bring an engineer to this conversation and I have the engineer and the business guy and the data analyst talk together, they come up with these great ideas. And I think a lot of it is about incubating those sort of communities in large organizations to build curious sort of results and outcomes driven data teams that have those disciplines, and they start to cross pollinate and cross train. That doesn't happen overnight. And it certainly isn't the big bang, the big, sort of, wow, everyone gets machine learning now sort of outcome that a lot of people want or they think they deserve. But it is it's a different way of looking at data. It's a different way of using data. And most people aren't ready for it, frankly.
Yeah, that makes sense, actually. Yeah. I think overall, like talking with you, I see like the emphasis that you're putting on statistics. I think that's kind of the old field. Machine learning is kind of like the new term which everyone wants to use, but at its core, it's mostly math and statistics, the kind of the first principles view of looking at the data.
If we're talking about, there's a lot more to it than just statistics. Especially when we start talking about like convolutional neural networks, we start talking about like, sort of language vectorization and sort of cross discipline, everything, all of those sorts of concepts. A lot of machine learning aims to break that down. I mean, if we're talking about the nuts and bolts, it breaks it down into tensors, into arrays, into math. Yeah. Yeah. And, it is not a single sort of algorithm, a single, statistical calculation. It's many, many, many on top of each other.
Yep.
But if you understand as you said, and I think it's the right way to put it, if you understand first principles and you are confident in kind of the basics of those.
Yes.
As they get more complicated, I think I rely on open source software in a lot of ways to sort of bridge the gap between first principles and outcomes for me at times. But I'm always curious to go back in and look at like, what did it really do? What did that, was a really cool thing I just built. But when I've got some spare time and the project's done and I don't have clients, trying to figure out what's next. Like I spend my time looking at that going, wow, this is, it is interesting that, these research papers, and for me, the most valuable stuff is reading the research paper and then reading kind of the code that goes with it. And even better when there are multiple implementations of the same algorithm in different frameworks. I think one that I've been playing with recently, YOLO, the image object detection algorithm. I learned a lot by reading the paper and then kind of looking at the progression of the multiple versions of that algorithm that they had, and then looking at it both in, I think they call it darknet. And then like I happened to be lazy and I like Keras at times. So there was a Keras implementation of YOLO v3 and just side by side looking at how the neural network is set up. It is like, it's looking at those differences that really helps me go deeper on this stuff and understand not just, hey, you want to use this type of algorithm, or hey, you want to use this sort of platform and this this package and this algorithm. But it's really about like, well, what if I start tweaking these little things here and there, and how can I make this not just really cool and interesting, but actually sort of usable and commercially viable and something that as a service someone would want to use? Because again, object detection is a cool idea. getting the data ready for it sucks. You know, serving it in a way that, you know, is useful, yeah, also not the easiest. Building the model, like, shoot, you can do it, you know, tutorial a day for months and you would have many, many different implementations. But it's that sort of, you know, taking it that last mile is critical. And I like learning more about them. And I find it helps me build not just my own confidence, but my client's confidence in what they're doing. But you know, that it's still all about how do I make it useful, right?
Yeah, that is cool. Actually, you give a very good advice, which is that look at like the Keras implementation, which is a very high level. Look at, say, PyTorch or TensorFlow implementation, which is a little bit below, and also read the paper. So kind of like seeing the progression and
I'm a masochist. I'm pretty sure Darknet was in C++. So it was fairly low level, but it was, fascinating to read.
Which brings me to the next question, which is on the last mile, or rather the first mile, which is data collection. So the data collection, as we have seen in the news, like the privacy and this entire aspect of kind of like the data ownership is becoming very crucial. And that is the first mile. So the entire field of machine learning depends on kind of having the data that you mentioned just now. So what are your pointers on data ownership and data collection, and how should young entrepreneurs and kind of the young data scientists go about collecting their data?
All right. So I've got to be really honest and tell you that this is a problem that it sucks for everyone, and everyone's upset about it no matter what side of the game you're on. So if you're, you know, some guy who's upset with Apple because of their terms of service, the data collection they kind of go through, I get it. Like, the more and more we see things like IoT invade the rest of the world, as many people see it, we see more and more data collection. And, you know, that there was an NPR sort of story years ago, and it wasn't that many years ago, it was probably 3-4 years ago. And all I remember from it was this one statement, and he said that data is ambient now. And it's not just that data is something that we could go get, but it's literally everywhere. You know, you can track people in their houses by their Wi-Fi signals. Not just track them, but like triangulate them within a few feet. It's crazy. So all that being said, I think that there is a personal opinion where I've decided for myself that, you know, they're going to track me anyway. I'm not going to not have a smartphone. I have an Alexa device. I have many, many computers. I have, a lot of, you know, sort of technology around me. There's really little way for me to continue to do what I do and not opt into some of that at some point. But I have empathy for people who get a little edgy about it, who are a little concerned, and I share their concern, because as we've seen with Facebook, and I think that we've got to be careful. There's the kind of Cambridge Analytica, Facebook sort of not malicious, but sort of less, you know, questionable usage of data that is collected technically legally because terms of service allowed it. And then there's the kind of data breach and sort of massive invasion of privacy that is generally illegal. And I think we can all agree that that's not a good thing. But, you know, I think as an entrepreneur, I have to make a decision, like you said, you know, where's my line? What is it that we're going to say is okay and not? And there's again, two levels. There's the legal side, which is, sure, we've got terms of service that we've got put out. We are careful not to be overly invasive, but legally we have a set of terms and services that outline kind of how we should, or how we collect data and what we do with it. Anyone who's in the data world who is building something new should have one of those. You know, hands down, make sure it's reviewed. Not just get it online, but make sure it's reviewed by an actual lawyer who has actual like experience in that space. That being said, then there's the other side of it, which is, well, what about all the speculative stuff? What about going out and scraping the web? What about just the stuff that we can pick up because it's there? And that's where we have licensing problems galore, right? So I think that there's a really strong line in my world between discovery work and sort of learning and speculative sort of questions. Hey, wouldn't it be cool if, or like, hey, you think that would work? Do you think, you know, we could build something that does, what was it? We use Project Gutenberg, but I had a guy who asked me, could we build a classifier that identified what your writing looks like, you know, top 100 authors in the public domain. And like, it didn't take that much work, but like, we started on that one first with, you know, what data do we have? What could we build with it? But in most conversations, we don't start with data. We start with a question, which is, you know, is it possible for us to detect the emotion of faces in a crowd? There's an interesting question. Well, crap, how do you find pictures of crowds? And then how does that not get creepy really quickly? So, you know, I think that you have to start with, you know, some questions. You have to start with, you know, speculative work. And then if you've decided to use sort of public available scrape data, you know, however you go about that, once you transition from I'm learning and trying to figure it out to I'm building for production, you need to go back and evaluate the sort of licensing status of the data that you did capture. And that might mean that you have to go buy data from someone. It might mean that you have to go find public open source, public domain data. And I think just like in the software world, you have to be super diligent about what licenses you are consuming and what that requires of you. So what kind of disclosures, what kind of statements you have to make, what you have to do because you've used this open source license. And there are plenty of you know, great tools out there to help you kind of keep an eye on that. Open source license, you know, sort of site, sort of interpretive sort of structures of, you know, is it copy left? Do you need to do X, Y, and Z? Must you package the source with it? You know, what are all the things that you need to kind of keep in mind. It's literally the same set of questions that you would ask if you're packaging open source software, but it is for data, which is kind of a fun twist to it. But once you figure that out, I think you've got to be careful to make sure that when you build your production stuff that you go push in a distributable or as in a service, or you're just using in production, that is always sourced from data that you have, you know, lineage on, that you know where it came from, you know that your licensing is clear on it, that you either own or have license to use it freely and, you know, in a, you know, way that's acceptable to you.
So I have a question on, which is kind of more about the resources that you mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. What are your kind of your favorite books, resources, or podcasts that you listen to?
I have a couple of books that I generally recommend. Sometimes, you can take it in a couple of different directions, but a lot of the people who work with me in a consulting world or in the consulting world, I'll recommend that they read a book called The Field Guide to Understanding Human Error. And it is a book that I 100% recommend that people read. I really, 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 really recommend that you do not read it on a plane. I did, which was a mistake. But the entire book is about what human error sort of outputs are in root cause analysis. And, you know, from a consulting perspective, it's all about, you know, the idea that pilots don't go to work every day to drive planes into the ground. So what context did they have in that moment that contributed to them making a bad decision? And it's all about flipping that blame question around, and it's a very analytical book. So it's not we're not talking about like a big feel good like rom-com sort of book. It's very much about, you know, how they investigate these plane crashes, and, you know, everything, you know, I guess, you know, in the news lately, it's that sensor in the 737 MAX, right? Yeah. It gives pilots bad context, which is a part of why those planes fell out of the sky. Even when they've had, like, there was one case in the book about, you know, a pilot with a mental health problem. Well, yes, the pilot had bad context because he wasn't, you know, in a good place himself. But why was he allowed to have that context in flight in the pilot's chair? You know, what part of the system failed him? Not that every person, you know, is going to be of, you know, perfect intention. But I think that it's a really good lens to look at things through. The other that I always recommend, and again, you know, from a consulting perspective, it's great from a, how do you talk to people and work through problems? Mm. But on the data side, it's all about, like, put your ego aside. It's easy to blame the person. It's easy to blame this. And let's be dispassionate. Let's really dig into the detail and exhaust all of our answers. The other one is actually a whole lot more interesting than it sounds, especially for math nerds. But it's called Information Theory, a Tutorial Introduction. It's all about Claude Shannon and his sort of groundbreaking work around information theory that was essentially the sort of foundational structure for things like the internet. But it is a, you know, little, you know, so 200-300 page paperback, and it rips through the entirety of kind of, you know, information versus data, signal versus noise, and kind of, you know, the, not just the sort of practical aspects of it, but the math. Like, what is it like? It's interesting that you can actually, you know, a lot of the things that we sort of talk about colloquially, you know, the actual concept under the hood is very, very quantitative. It is very numbers driven. It's very, very specific. And it gave me a much greater respect for not just how things like the internet work, but that these patterns and these heuristics that we, you know, sort of as people follow, that have their backing in really fascinating, like, someone worked the math out and it works. And it's kind of cool to see that.
That's a book I need to pick. I think that's really sounds interesting, actually.
Yeah, I'll send you the links. They're great books.
That's great. Okay, I'll put them in the show notes as well for the listeners. Is there something that you want to promote or somewhere where the listeners can find you?
Yeah, like I said, I'm a terrible salesperson, but I will say this, that, you know, we're building this company called Introspect Data, focused on helping people really drive value out of ML. I think that's the one of the things that really people struggle with, is that they're all these cool, shiny things, but, you know, we can do the shiny things too, and we like doing that, but it doesn't make sense until we can drive it into something that helps companies move faster, drive forward, improve their situation. So, you know, we love, you know, bringing on new clients. We love talking to people. We love, you know, big projects. We love small projects. One of the things that we really pride ourselves on is not really having a huge sort of niche focus. We like a lot of variety. And we've, you know, I've done that in companies previously, and I find that external context, that set of patterns from other industries, that kind of multidisciplinary approach, it serves us really well in the data world, because we can bring, you know, patterns that, you know, maybe in the oil and gas industry made a lot of sense, and in the financial industry, nobody thinks about it that way. And it really has a major impact. You know, kind of that cross-pollination effect is something that we, I think it's fun for us, but we find our clients really enjoy. So introspectdata.com is the website. It's easy to get a hold of me. It's patrick@introspectdata.com. I'm really tough to figure out. First name basis, it's good stuff. But again, we love talking to people, and if anyone out there is looking for some help, has a project that they're trying to figure out, even if it's something you need help figuring out, we're happy to chat, give you some insight, and see where it goes from there.
Sounds great. And you guys are based out of San Diego, I believe?
We are. San Diego, California.
But you're cool with talking with anyone kind of all over, right?
We've got clients everywhere right now, from Singapore to London. So
fantastic.
We are all over the place. We do a lot of, we travel quite a bit, but find that we can find a good balance between kind of travel and remote work to kind of get a lot of these teams working. And I mean, the other thing is, our goal isn't to take work away from people or to do it for them generally. Like, we'll help move things forward, but my goal is always to help companies really sort of get the flywheel spinning to get them successful long term. So we see it much more as coaching and enablement versus sort of classic consulting. So, you know, a lot of this is stuff that we, you know, we work with teams, we coach, we help, we sort of, you know, bring the strategy and help organizations move. We'll sit down for a week or two to start and check in every month or two in person. But we do a lot of the kind of nuts and bolts of things, you know, either remotely or asynchronously.
Okay, that sounds great. I'm sure listeners can learn a lot from looking at your work and reaching out to you.
Yeah.
So thanks for being on the show, Patrick. It was an absolute pleasure to have you here. We learned quite a ton. Thanks for taking your time today.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right, that was the episode. If you really enjoyed that, please don't forget to rate, subscribe, and share this episode with as many people as possible. And looking forward to hearing your feedback on the datalifepodcast@gmail.com. You can also reach out to me via the Anchor voice messages. The link to that is available in the show notes in the end. Thanks for listening, and hope you enjoyed this interview, and hope to hear from you in future. Thanks for listening. Have a great week ahead.